Tonight on Arena, violinist Maxime Vengerov on performing Sibelius' violin concerto and Graham Thompson on his new biography of Scottish singer-songwriter John Martin. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and we are available on the live stream, rte.ie/arena. This Friday, March the 22nd, Grammy Award winning violinist Maxime Vengerov, often referred to as the greatest living string player alive, will be making his much anticipated return to the National Concert Hall, where he will once again be teaming up with the National Symphony Orchestra and conductor David Brophy. He will be performing Sibelius' Violin Concerto, truly one of the great concertos of the violin repertoire. Being a passionate teacher, of course, Maxime will also be working with three advanced students in a masterclass taking place through the National Concert Hall's Learning and Participation Programme. Ahead of his performance on Friday, he will work with these players on the Sibelius Violin Concerto, and each one of these will then be assigned a movement of the concerto to prepare. Delighted to have Maxime Vengerov in studio with me this evening. And I love that student aspect of things, Maxime. Have you met the three students yet, or did you just arrive today?
First of all, it's fantastic to be here with you. Thank you for having me in the show. Yes, I just arrived recently, but already we have done some work with students. You know, helping my younger colleagues to develop musically and technically also is part of my DNA. You know, from the very early stages of my career, I've been very lucky to receive greatest advice from my mentors such as Rostropovich and Barenboim, and I played with all wonderful conductors. And you know, it's giving back. Yeah. It's giving back, and we have already done now some great work with piano preparation for the orchestra. And today, the students, the fantastic students, three of them, each of them a different character, have already made their first appearance with orchestra, which is a great stress to be in the front of professional orchestra conducted by wonderful maestro David Brophy. And it's just such a great stress for them. So I'm trying to relieve that.
I wonder, though, and people will say, well, what do the students get? I don't think it's not hard to work out. They get to work with you, one of the greatest violin players alive, obviously. But I'm wondering about the equation the other way around. What do you get? Particularly a piece like the Sibelius Violin Concerto, which I'm sure you've listened to recordings of all the great players playing it. But when you work with this concerto with young emerging violinists and those who will make mistakes, and of course that's part of the game, and who are learning, what do you learn from them?
Yeah, it's interesting and amusing, because I started playing the concerto for the first time. I played it when I was at the age of 17. So, and since then, you know, then I recorded with Maestro Barenboim in Chicago Symphony Orchestra, then recorded it again, but in different version, the original version, which is even more advanced, you know, longer and more technically advanced. Then came back to the normal version, that one performs, which is the second version of the concerto.
And not very easy. Let's be,
yes,
not
yes.
Exactly. It's not not a cakewalk.
So, you know, every time I teach the concerto and I have to put some things in words, I discover so many things. It's this, first of all, the score is a magnificent source that every time you look at one line and you discover another color or another vertical or another dimension of this concerto, it's endless. Today I was sitting in the rehearsal and I was discovering so many things. And then later sharing it with the students, is you learn yourself so much.
Let's have a listen to the opening. The opening of this concerto, it's almost as if it's way off in the distance.
It's
somewhere.
Totally surrealistic. It's like a painting.
Yeah, it kind of shimmering off. Yeah. The orchestra is shimmering in behind.
Yeah, it shouldn't have the material. So, when the orchestra is done, one should wonder where these sounds come. You know, we have never heard such things before.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to that opening movement. And after about 10 seconds, then in come, this is you actually, with the aforementioned Chicago Symphony Orchestra and Barenboim. So there we have it, the opening section, the very first movement of the Violin Concerto of Jan Sibelius. And that was a recording featuring the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Barenboim and Maxim Vengerov as a young soloist, 1995.
Yeah, I was 22 or 23.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You know, I feel it totally differently now.
Yeah, you were saying as we listened, I play that differently.
Yeah, now. I was actually, for a long time, I didn't hear it. Mm. I usually do that, you know, when I record something, I listen a lot during the post-production, and then I just forget about the recording, which helps me to reinvent the work. You know, when I studied with Rostropovich, who is my mentor for 17 years, I had the greatest fortune to work with him. And Rostropovich was a great master that had his teachers as Shostakovich and Prokofiev. Britten is a friend.
Straight line down.
Yes, unbelievable. So for me, what I learned from Slava is that you always have to reinvent the work as if this is the world premiere. And actually, when we listen to the concerto, as you rightly said, it's as if it was composed yesterday.
Yeah, it does feel very fresh. It does feel more like a contemporary piece of music, or certainly a late 20th century piece of music, as opposed to an early. I was checking with you, was it 19th century or 20th? It's just the beginning of the 20th century. But as I listen to that as well, I can't help but hear that melody at the beginning of it. It has. I was asking you before we came to air, is it a Finnish melody? Is it a Russian melody? Because it has both qualities in there, doesn't it?
Well, Sibelius, being one of the greatest symphonists of all time, composing, it's a symphony basically with the solo line and the way the score it is written. That's why when we go through the composition with students, we don't only pay attention to the solo line, but how it actually integrates into the texture of the orchestra. And we draw the colors according to what we hear in the orchestra. And the orchestra is actually, most of the times, is our leader. Yes. So depending on how the strings will play, the violin will come and continue.
Because the violin melody grows out of it. But I was also interested in that kind of borderless nature, if you like, of music.
Yeah, image-wise, it's totally fantastic work because it presents so many colors unlike any other piece written before.
Yeah, but it is that I'm hearing both a Russian melody and a Finnish melody in there. And I know the last time you were in with us, in fact, it was just after the Ukrainian war had started. And you have one parent is Ukrainian, one parent is Russian. We're this far into the conflict now. Playing a piece like that, how does that speak to you? And you're a UNICEF ambassador as well.
Oh gosh, it's difficult times today, and music is such. Helps us to escape, is the savior today. You know, I'm so happy and so blessed to be a musician, to travel around the world and to escape the moments of horrors today, what is happening in the world. And to, you know, to show that there is light in the end of the dark tunnel. And that's what this music shows. It exactly goes from darkness to light. It's this constant fight that also this struggle and the light winning over darkness is also in Beethoven, in most of the greatest.
Yeah, and one of the Beethoven symphonies has been played as part of the concert on Friday night as well. The other, you've mentioned Slava, as you call him, your old buddy Rostropovich, a couple of times. But the other great mentor, I think it's fair to say, Barenboim was one of those as well. And of course, his own orchestra, that orchestra that has brought together players from all over the Middle East into one musical family playing together. How important, what can music achieve in that regard, given particularly the Gaza-Israeli conflict at the moment?
Yes, like Barenboim rightly says, so that with music you could actually see how musicians, even if they have different opinions of one particular work, let's say, you know, there are four people playing in quartet, but they are on stage and in rehearsal, if they love the composition and music is our leader, they have to find a common language because they're, you know, and so the same thing is humanity. Like, you know, the short answer, God is one and we are neighbors. We have to find peaceful ways for coexistence. This is the short answer. And music is really, therefore, a great example.
Let's listen to the third movement, a little bit of the third movement of the Sibelius Violin Concerto. I think this is my favorite movement of the work, because what you get is here, it's this tension between the orchestra kind of trying to burst out and the violin trying to burst out, but somehow Sibelius contains everything. Come back to this recording of you as a young fella.
It's a Tame the Horses.
Yeah. The Tame the Horses movement. Yeah. Okay. The Tame the Horses movement from Sibelius's Violin Concerto. Eventually, the orchestra, the whole orchestra comes in there. That's the Taming the Horses movement, as I'm now going to call it, from the third movement of Sibelius's Violin Concerto, which Maxim Vengerov will be playing in the National Concert Hall this coming Friday evening. I kind of was checking. It's almost like a duet between the timpani and the violin. Yeah, the bass is rumbling there in the background somewhere, giving it a little bit of texture. Right, yeah. But it's essentially, who would have thought a duet between the timpani and the violin?
Yes, totally surreal, yes. And you could, he probably took this idea of timpani from the Beethoven Violin Concerto that starts from the timpani.
So that matches with the programming of the Beethoven Symphony.
Yeah, I'm just suspecting that's what's happened. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And so, given all of that and the performance on Friday evening, there's also a big birthday on the way, I believe.
15. Oh, 50.
You're 50.
Yes.
And the feeling of that. And what will there be celebrations? Will you be playing? What will you do?
Yeah, I'm taking my whole family during summer, end of July, on an Asian tour. Going to start with Thailand for some nice holidays and jet lag, getting over the jet lag. And then we go for my concerts, which will be in Australia, New Zealand. And then subsequently, I have 10 concerts in China. 11 concert, I think, yeah. Singapore.
What are the Mozart? You're doing the Mozart concertos. This is in Carnegie Hall. It's part of a series called, it's a 3-year perspectives. What are you looking at there? Because it's with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, famously no conductor. It's the orchestra looking at each other and playing with each other rather than being conducted by somebody on the outside.
Yeah, during the 3-year perspective at Carnegie Hall, I will have the possibility and opportunity to play different kinds of repertoire, conduct master classes, educational projects, and play with chamber orchestra. We're starting our first program is with two concerts on consecutive days with all Mozart, five concertos, and concertone and concertante with viola and violin. And so this is over 2 days. Then a master class with students again with orchestra.
And Mozart and Sibelius, two different albums
totally different altogether. Yes, totally different style.
I'm wondering about the student now that you have given the third movement to. You said that all three students have different personalities in the Sibelius Violin Concerto. The Taming the Horses one. I wonder how that particular student is going. How would you describe the other two movements? Because they're, you know, the first movement we had that kind of ethereal opening.
Yeah,
how do you describe it?
It's difficult to put, in one word, and I don't want to sound like put the cliche on each movement. But I think the first movement is a symphony, but is with the image of the raw nature, with all its fascinating northern lighting, if you want, you know. The second movement is more like operatic, is like an aria, you know, accompanied by the orchestra, where the singer is evidently there. Yeah. It's really
devoted. Yeah, because I suppose it's more the slow moving, more melodic. So we have the Northern Lights, an opera, and Taming the Horses.
That sounds good.
Yeah. That's what you'd be playing on Friday evening. Lovely to see you, Maxim. Thanks so much for coming in to see us. That's Maxim Vengerov. And Maxim will perform with the National Symphony Orchestra under conductor David Brophy at the National Concert Hall this Friday evening. Mozart and Beethoven, I believe. Haydn and Beethoven, Symphony number 7 of Beethoven and Haydn's 46th Symphony are the two works that will be performed around the Sibelius Violin Concerto performed by Maxim Vengerov. Graham Thompson is the author of acclaimed biographies of Kate Bush, Phil Lynott, George Harrison and Johnny Cash. In Small Hours, The Long Night of John Martin, he turns his attention to a Scottish singer-songwriter best known for his blend of jazz and folk, a combination that often saw him compared with Nick Drake, for whom he was said to have named his most famous album Solid Air in 1973. John Martin was an innovative artist, an astonishing guitarist as well as songwriter. His creative heyday came in the late 60s and 70s when he released a series of acclaimed albums, from London Conversation in 1967 to One World 10 years later. Martin always had a strong connection with Ireland, and he spent the last years of his life, in fact, in Kilkenny. He died there in 2009 at the age of 60. Delighted to have Graham Thompson join me now on the programme. He's in Edinburgh this evening. Phil Lynott, Kate Bush, George Harrison, Johnny Cash, household names, I think it's safe to say, in those cases. Not necessarily the case, would you agree, Graham, for John Martin? Why did you want to write about him in Small Hours?
Good evening, Sean. Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. I keep waiting for him actually to have that kind of Nick Drake style, you know, post cult breakthrough, and it hasn't really happened. Well, I was fascinated with him. I actually met him 3 or 4 years before he died. He was in Thomastown in Kilkenny, as you say, living there. And I went over for a magazine piece and met him, and I was just fascinated by this guy. You know, he was a very, very compelling personality. And also, I think musically, he's just one of these people who there is no equal to him, really. Or there's certainly no comparable artist to John Martin. Nobody sounds like him. Nobody played guitar like him. Nobody sang like him. Nobody wrote songs like him. So someone like that, I think, is always going to be interesting to write about. And then when you dig deeper into his life, which was a very complex and layered and often murky affair, and you try and kind of map the music to the life, then that's kind of got me hooked, even if it, as you say, is not someone who is necessarily a household name.
Yeah, and I suppose it's trying to work out those aspects of those multifaceted sides to the musician and how they are or are not reflected in the man himself. But if we talk about his childhood in Glasgow, Graham, there are two aspects to this. The musical side of it, because he came from a very musical family, and then perhaps the emotional side of it that we might come to a little bit later on. But talk to me about the musical side and the nature of both of his parents were entertainers, the nature of music that he might have heard around the house that he would have heard in the Glasgow he was growing up in.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very, very eclectic pool from which he drew, really. His parents were both light entertainers, I guess. You know, they would play in the theatres. They had a singing double act. So they would play in plays and they would sing, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan and that kind of repertoire, and comedic songs and light opera. And so he had a lot of that around the house. There was a lot of classical music around the house, but also his father's family came from the west coast of Scotland. So there was a real source of traditional music as well, folk music and blues. You know, he was part of that generation that picked up on the blues revival of the 50s and 60s, and he really tapped into that and probably always regarded himself at heart as a blues man. And his granny played piano. There was a very musical household in Glasgow. So,
And Glasgow itself,
it was very, very widespread.
Yeah, and Glasgow itself, and I think you bring this up in the book, the importance of a place called Clive's Incredible Folk Club, where he appeared in the 1960s. Was it very much, I mean, I love the sound of it, I have to say. The word incredible covers a multitude, I'm guessing. But was that very much the singer and his or her guitar, or, you know, that kind of really solid folk scene, or was there more than that going on there?
it was kind of a blend of the two at that point. It was just when folk was starting to go a bit psychedelic and a bit curly around the edges. And it was, The Incredible is a reference to the Incredible String Band. So it was some of these traditional artists like Matt McGinn, who were playing, you know, quite straight traditional and often quite kind of quite comedic brands of folk music. And then you had people like Clive Palmer and like Mike Heron and Robin Williamson and the guys from the Incredible String Band, who were really pushing at the edges of what was possible in traditional music or using acoustic instruments at that time. So he was very much the sort of younger, you know, he would only have been 15, 16 when he was sort of dropping into those sessions, but he picked up really, really quickly. And there was a great Hamish Unlach, who was kind of the titan of that scene and the sort of the father figure, I guess, who took him under his wing and took him up to his house and taught him things. And so he learned very, very quickly. And although he could always tap into that traditional side of folk music, he was always a kind of pioneering spirit at heart.
Yeah, and we'll come to certainly some of the pioneering music shortly. But I want to listen to, I suppose, what most people will recognise immediately as his, I guess, his certainly his most popular hit, and I think one that taps very much in to the folk side of his personality. From John Martin there, and with me on the programme this evening, Graham Tonson, talking to me about his book Small Hours, The Long Night of John Martin. It's an immediately accessible song, that, Graham, from John Martin, but that guitar playing, many as a teenage boy tried his hand, and girl I'm sure as well, at trying to get anything close to what he does on the guitar. It's phenomenal playing as well as singing.
It's astonishing, and it really swings. You know, I think that's what sets him apart from a lot of his contemporaries. It is the groove. There's always this underlying rhythm that's motoring those songs. Danny Thompson, his great foil, who played bass guitar with him for so long, you know, called him Badfinger because he had this thumb that just kept pulsing out the groove on the acoustic guitar. And you watch him at his peak, and you can't really see where all the sound is coming from. You can't quite work out how he is doing what he's doing with just
two hands.
It's quite astonishing.
Or two hands, yeah. And you know, I'm minded of Paul Brady and some of that guitar style as well. You can hear similarities between the two of them, I think, as well. But I mentioned, Graham, about the two sides. There was the musicality within the family and all of those musical influences that were happening to him, particularly in the folk clubs of the day. But there was a difficult enough emotional life at home as well.
That's right. You know, his parents split up very, very early on in their marriage, and John was only 2 or 3 years old. And unusually, I guess, for that time, you know, he moved back with his father's family. So he didn't live with his mom. He went back to Glasgow and lived with his dad and his dad's wider family. And I think that caused him a lifetime's worth of pain, really, that sense of abandonment from his mother, although he did see her sporadically. It wasn't necessarily a very close relationship. And also she was English. And he had throughout his life this kind of dichotomy between being Scottish, which essentially he was, although he was
very
born
Celtic
in England,
soul.
and absolutely, you hear it in the music, but also this other side, this kind of this English bucolic side, and you know, his accent would flip flop dramatically between the two depending on the circumstances. So there was always this sort of binary thing with John Martin, you know, light and dark, English, Scottish. Soft and hard, you know, you can hear it in the music, and you certainly could experience it when you met the man.
And certainly in his relationships, I think you spoke to his first wife in particular, didn't you, Beverly? His relationships were sometimes went to very dark places.
They did, yeah. And I didn't want to duck that in the book, and I certainly wouldn't have. Yeah, you know, he was an abusive man. He was abusive to many women in his relationships, and also to other people around him. He could be very violent, very aggressive, very coercive. That was a very lively, you know, live part of his nature. And you know, he damaged a lot of people. He definitely damaged himself by the end of his life and throughout his life, but he damaged a lot of people around him. And yes, as I say, those kind of binaries in the amount of love and heart you hear in the music, there's a huge amount of anger and rage as well there that played out in his life.
He signed to Island Records, and he was kind of, I think, thought of there as the favorite wayward child syndrome. He kind of had that label on him, and I suppose there was the album Solid Air came out of that period. How important was that, being left to himself, being left to his own creative devices by Island? How important was that in his development?
I think he was hugely fortunate to have Chris Blackwell, who was, you know, is a true music man. And although he was running a record company, really was about the music and letting his artists explore what they wanted to do and express themselves. And he was very fortunate in that respect. And maybe it played against him a little bit, you know, because Solid Air, you know, you can see the beginnings there of quite a commercially successful career. And yet within 6 months, you know, he was given carte blanche to go and make this incredible album called Inside Out, which is brilliant, but is hugely uncommercial. And it kind of derailed any train that might have been traveling down towards, you know, mainstream success. Whether that was deliberate or not, I don't know. But he was allowed to just go out and express himself. And he, you know, he was an artist who did it differently every time. It was always going to be exciting, different. Yeah, you know, jazz ethic, I suppose, in how you played.
Yeah, and I think, where does the track listening Glyndebourne, where does that come in this development? Because it certainly is not, I don't think this is on the commercial side of things.
Well, that was just before Solid Air. That's the first real expression of him playing with the Echoplex. You know, he had this incredible kind of box of tricks that would send out these huge waves of reverb from his acoustic guitar. And that was the first track, really, in 1971 on Bless the Weather, which is a beautiful record. That's the first signs of him, I think, really starting to push away from the more kind of conventional folk sounds and trying to do something
let's have a listen
much
to
more
it.
Experimental.
Yeah, way more experimental, and a 6.5-minute song. But let's just listen to how he opens this up and really noodles around between piano and guitar here. Glistening Glyndebourne from John Martin. Have a little section, just the opening section of Glistening Glyndebourne from John Martin. And with me this evening on the programme, Graham Thompson, talking about his biography of John Martin, Small Hours, The Long Night of John Martin. Obviously, we're not overwrought by the particular the lyrical content of that particular song, certainly in the opening sections, Graham. But you talk about this. A lot of people will think of him in terms of the lyrical songs. May You Never Been a perfect example of that. You know, there's kind of a quite straightforward lyricism to it. But you say he was not an overtly literary writer. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Or what do you mean by that precisely?
Well, I think I mean that he moved away from writing kind of linear songs. And I suppose if we think of the folk tradition where you have a number of verses that tell a story in a kind of A to B to C fashion, that's not what he did. You know, he was a sort of circular writer, I think, in terms of really trying to express a mood. And I think what you hear there and then what happened later throughout the 70s was him trying to bring everything into focus so that it was not just the lyrics. It was using his voice as an instrument. You know, he was very inspired by Pharoah Sanders and you know, these free jazzers and trying to express an emotion through the way he used his voice and also through manipulating the guitar. And I think he saw the lyrics more and more as just a kind of another part of that, an adjunct to that, really, not about expressing a kind of linear story, but about fulfilling that mood. Yeah. And he is one of the most atmospheric artists that there is. You know, he conjures up an atmosphere, I think, better than virtually anyone I can think of.
You did say, Graham, that you didn't want to shy away from the darker sides of the, you know, the bad behaviour in relationships, his abusive behaviour towards people, not just partners, but also business partners, not just emotional partners, business partners as well. Despite that, though, the many flaws, the many faults, and you do give us, you know, you do as you ask, as you say you will, you don't shy away from it. Despite that wreckage in his personal life and the devastation he wrought on others, you do, I think, come to the conclusion that the good heart of the music shines through, I think is precisely what you said. Does the music redeem the man for you?
I don't think it's that simplistic or that straightforward, shall I say. I think it's one wouldn't exist without the other. And I think what I meant is that, you know, the humanity you hear in the music, the desire for love and for connection you hear in that music is real. I don't think it's inauthentic or fake. I think it really comes from a real place in that human being. And maybe that was the best expression of that part of his personality that he could give. And it doesn't sound, you know, and he could give it in real life as well. There were people who really cared for him and spoke very movingly about how tender he could be at times. But there was another side too. And I think that's just, it's a human being, isn't it? And as I kind of wrote the book, I realized that it's not really resolvable. You can't tie it all up in a nice bow and go, well, you know, this equals that. It's just, this is a human being. He was deeply, deeply flawed and did some awful things. But I think the music is authentic. I think it stands for things that he did believe in and things that he wanted to say. And perhaps it's the best part of him that we have left is the songs.
Well, Graham, thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Graham Thompson. Small Hours, The Long Night of John Martin, Graham's new book, is published by Omnibus Press. There you go. Will you ever guess who we're going to speak about now? Jennifer Lopez built a massively successful triple threat career as an actress, dancer and musician to become the global superstar known to fans simply as J-Lo. She began appearing in films in the late 1980s, quickly became one of the highest paid Latina actresses in Hollywood. She later found crossover success in the music industry with a series of well-received albums garnering on the way notoriety for her multiple entrepreneurial projects and her romances with other big names in the entertainment industry. Last month, she released This Is Me Now, a love story, full-length movie in which Jennifer Affleck transforms herself into the legendary American singer, actress and pop culture icon known as J-Lo. Yes, she's playing herself, or at least a rather strange version of herself. Louise Bruton is with me this evening to look at the many aspects of the career of J-Lo. It's easy to laugh, I suppose, and it's easy to be a little bit cynical, as I may perhaps have that tone in my voice at the moment, but she is phenomenally successful and she did, you know, do it herself.
She did, and that is something that I think that she could also be known for. It's her work ethic, and that comes across whenever she does interviews, and especially in the numerous films that she's released in the last month. So she's a busy woman, but she started out as a dancer, and she worked her way up. Choosing, she could have easily have gone on tour with Janet Jackson in 1993 as a backup dancer for her, but she decided, no, I'm going to focus on acting. And then almost immediately, she was getting roles and nominations for being in films called Mi Familia, and then Francis Ford Coppola getting her in to act opposite Robin Williams in a movie, Jack. And then shortly after that, she was in the Steven Soderbergh film with George Clooney, Out of Sight. So she was building up a huge name for herself, having come from nowhere. And just as she was becoming known as a huge actress, she decided, why not? I'll sing as well. And in 1999, she released her debut album, On the Six.
And the two things from that point seemed to go hand in hand. It was very much singer and actor. She wasn't one or the other, was she?
Yeah, and neither of them were particularly better than the other. Like, that could be said, none was as bad as the other.
I was
going to
say, neither was worse than the other either.
Exactly. Yeah. But this was kind of a common thing. Like, Will Smith did a very similar thing for most of his career. He was having box office hits and number one singles. So this was a concept that was very, very big in the 90s and early 2000s, where these sort of variety show type performers would just do everything. And she was very good in the rom-com era. She had lots of box office hits with Made in Manhattan, The Wedding Planner, and then every album she had was a number one hit up until about maybe 2004-ish.
Yeah, so she was kind of running the two things side by side. Made in Manhattan, I often wonder to what extent this is, it's not autobiographical, but there certainly seems to be, she's making a lot of points, or the character she's playing makes a lot of points that you might think that Jennifer Lopez herself wanted to make.
Yeah, well, she had to work harder than everybody else, and nobody really believed that she had enough talent or enough kind of brain power to get to the point where she was. But she has said time and time again throughout her career, and more specifically now, that she has had to work harder, as she's Puerto Rican. And she had to work a lot harder in the New York kind of dance scene to get recognized and to be taken seriously. But I think when you see how successful she was almost off the bat, she has been taken seriously. But it is something that she has made a big point of speaking up for other Latina women to be recognized for their talents.
Let's listen to her as Marissa in Made in Manhattan, I beg your pardon. She's confronted by Christopher. This is the Ralph Fiennes character. Now, he's a senatorial candidate. And it's very interesting what she kind of accuses him of in the midst of this clip.
I don't get it. What just happened?
What don't you get? I'm the maid.
Well, what was all this? Some kind of bet? A little game of what? Get the guests?
No. Look, I was trying on her clothes, and then you were there, and then you invited me out, and everything else.
And you thought you had to lie to keep me interested?
Who's kidding who here? You think you would have taken a second look at me if you knew I was the maid?
Well,
come on, with all due respect for your big-hearted politics, I don't think so, Mr.
Well,
Assemblyman.
How would you know? You didn't give me a chance. You stand on your soapbox, judging everyone, so sure that they're judging you.
And you think they're not? Come on, half the time I'm some stereotype that they're making fun of. The other half of the time I'm just invisible. You know what? Maybe that's the point. The first time you saw me, I was cleaning your bathroom floor, only you didn't see me.
Well, what was I supposed to? Introduce myself when I'm taking a leak? Come on, you can't nail me for that.
People, what are you doing? What
no,
are you doing?
Jerry,
well, come on, you
better
might
go.
As well be selling tickets,
no, I don't
God's
care.
Sake.
You care.
No, no,
Marissa?
No.
I just want the truth.
All right, you want the truth? There was a part of me that wanted to see what it felt like to have someone like you look at me the way you did just once.
That's Jennifer Lopez as Marissa and Ralph Fiennes as Christopher in a scene from Made in Manhattan. We're looking at the career of the multi-talented Jennifer Lopez this evening with Louise Bruton. And I know it's a romantic comedy, and I know that that's what this film is, but there are some very interesting points that she's making there about what that character had to do to get this white politician to look at her and take her seriously.
Yeah, just to be seen, just to be noticed, not to be immediately stereotyped because she is Latina, Puerto Rican in New York, that she could be the maid or the baby minder, or that she is actually a person who could have great power. So that is a big thing that she addresses in the documentary about the movie that she just released.
She's made a documentary about the movie about herself.
Yes, exactly. It's Everything's a Mouthful with this one. But this is from the greatest love story never told. So that's the autobiographical documentary that she's done. And she brings in her friend Fat Joe, who's a rapper who also grew up in the Bronx. And I believe he's of Dominican background as well. And the two of them say together, you don't see people like us in the positions that we are. So even though it is 2024, they've had to work a lot harder to get to the places that they are.
Yeah, and you get a sense of that in Jenny from the Block, you know, the song that we heard at the beginning there, because you have that rap and you have the singing as well going on, her singing alongside the rap. What defines her? How would you describe her musical style?
She has always leaned in towards kind of R&B and hip hop, and she does a lot of collaboration with big rap artists, so Ja Rule, Pitbull, LL Cool J, some of her biggest hits have been working with them, and a lot of her songs would actually sample huge 90s hip hop songs as well. So there is a lot of kind of knowledge in her music as well that proves that she is a fan. This isn't just her handing over the production rights to somebody else, although it has been questioned whether or not she does all of the vocals on her songs. She definitely does the verses, not necessarily the choruses. But it's in later years, she has maybe gone off piste a bit with this, where she is trying to sound a bit more like the current charts. But back then, she had a more defined sound, which is very edgy, very cool. And there is a reason why she hasn't had a hit in maybe a bit since 2011.
Well, we need to paraphrase a book title. We need to talk about Ben.
Need to talk about Ben. Yeah, Bennifer.
Bennifer Lopez. I love it. Yes, Bennifer. So we'll talk about Ben Affleck, obviously. So talk to me a little bit about their relationship and how it did it benefit both of them. Was it true love? Am I being cynical?
It is hard to know if it benefited them, at any certain point, because it was a very trashy, tabloidy time, and their relationship was the main focus of the tabloids for a very, very long time. They were only going out for about a year or two, and they featured prominently in each other's work. He's in the Jenny from the Block video. He got a lot of slack for that. They starred in what is known as one of the worst films of all time by many, many movie critics across the land, and anyone who loves to watch movies that are so bad that they're good. This isn't even it. So Jiggly, Giggly.
Or Gigli, I like to call it. Yeah.
Gigli, I think, tarnished both of their reputations for a very, very long time, with Jennifer Lopez taking slightly longer to pick up the pace that she once had. And I think she got discredited a lot for tarnishing the man who wrote Good Will Hunting. He was seen as the credible, serious actress, and she was seen as the silly pop star.
Okay. This is why I call it the ill-fated 2003 movie Gigli, Jennifer Lopez, Ben Affleck. Now, her character here is called Ricky, and this is the moment when she meets Larry Page, Ben Affleck, and this is their first meeting, and she wants to use his phone.
Hello.
Hi.
May I be of some assistance?
Well, that remains to be seen. Look, I'm sorry to bother you. It's just, I was wondering if it wouldn't be too much trouble if I could use your phone for a second. I just took a one bedroom in the front, and I've been waiting all day for the phone company to come hook me up, but, you know.
Yeah, it's just kind of a bad,
It'll only take a second, I promise. You know, it's probably a local call.
I can't, I'm sorry, you know.
I'll be in and out before you know it, I promise. Just leave a faint scent.
Yeah, all right, come on.
Thank you.
That is Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez in a scene there from the ill-fated 2003 film where it was Gigli, and Louise Bruton speaking to us about J-Lo's career this evening. And I was asking, you know, I was trying to get the lowdown on what exactly was the relationship status. So she was in a bit like the clip, she was in and out with no time. They didn't get married. They split up before the wedding because of all this pressure.
They broke up 3 days before the wedding, which they have said now was due to the media scrutiny that they were facing at the time. But a lot of the attention was of their own making. They leaned into it, and then it got too hard, and then they pulled away.
But 20 years later.
20 years later, both have been married and divorced and have had children with other people. And just as she ended one engagement with another man, she picked up where she left off with Ben Affleck, and the two of them have been married since July 2022.
So, and you know, I'm aware that I'm going to ask a question now about how her personal life has impacted on her career, and I've just asked loads of questions about her personal life. But how do, is she's not alone in as a woman getting that kind of, the attention is on who she's gone out with or what, who she in a relationship with, instead of on her and what she does.
Well, a lot of it is intertwined together. You can't separate one from the other at this point, because Jennifer Lopez is the all-round celebrity, and she will push every element of her life forward in a way. And even in the movie The Greatest Story Never Told, she admits that she shared a lot of the private letters that Ben Affleck shared with her to her creative team. And he is saying in the corner, he's like, I'm actually a private guy, so you know, whatever you need to do to make your art. So she is sort of, she is pushing very hard for this narrative. And it does, it fits in quite nicely that they were the biggest couple 20 years ago, and now they're happy, married, settled down, making movies together again.
And the music, is the music still
the
happening?
Music is not happening. Not at well,
moment.
It's bombing at the moment.
Yeah.
And that's putting it lightly. And unfortunately, the This Is Me Now Then movie, a mouthful once again, it overshadows the music, and it was meant to be a vehicle to celebrate the music.
I want to finish up by listening to a clip from Hustler, because many people thought she was unlucky to miss out on the Oscars for an Oscar for this, didn't they?
Yeah, it was known as one of the biggest snubs for the 2019 Oscars. It was an incredible movie. She was one of the executive producers involved. It was just a great ensemble, great performance.
She was essentially a group of dancers in a strip club.
Yeah, she was known as a veteran stripper, and her dancing experience played in hugely into the role. And if you're interested in learning more about her, there's a great the halftime documentary about her halftime performance at the Super Bowl really captures the true work ethic that she's been talking about.
Let's listen to a clip featuring Constance Wu, who's playing the character of Destiny, and Ramona, which is the J-Lo character here, who basically Destiny wants to know, how can I be like you? How can I get everything like you seem to have managed to do?
How come you're so good? I see you with every single kind of guy, and I don't know, it's like you have them all figured out.
I guess I'm just a people person.
It's easier if you think of them as like your rich friends.
Yeah, some of them are not so bad. Where else you dance?
I was at Sin City for way too long. And then I heard some Boiler Room guys saying how all the money was in the city, so.
You followed the green brick road.
Yep.
So far, so good?
I mean, it's okay.
Get out. I mean, you must be cleaning up. You're new. You're fucking gorgeous. You're Asian. It's like a triple threat.
Well, I'm not that good. I mean, I don't know, showed me moves.
There we go. Apologies, I should have warned you about the language in that clip. From Hustler, Jennifer Lopez and Constance Wu. I was asking you, Louise Bruton, just before we finish up, when did the J-Lo moniker come into play?
So her second album is called J-Lo, but it was kind of her media nickname, and she embraced it.
Yeah.
She kind of she's always taking what's the worst thrown at her and makes it gold.
What's next for her? What's next for Bennifer?
Bennifer, well, hopefully this marriage lasts longer than they intend to. But I would love to see her take on rom-com roles, because she does have a certain charisma on screen.
She does.
And while the music isn't delivering, she definitely is on the right track following Hustlers.
All right, that's Louise Bruton speaking to us about J-Lo, Jennifer Lopez, whichever you prefer to call her. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Paula Shields and Niall Fitzmaurice researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator this evening. Mark Dwyer was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I won't be with you tomorrow night. Kay Sheehy will be in the seat. I'll be back with you on Thursday. And John Creedon will be with you after the news.